Okay, Genesis chapter 16, and this is probably my favorite chapter of the book. Now you'd say, that's kind of bizarre, but it was Genesis chapter 16 that opened my eyes to the idea that this book is a presentation of the gospel in lengthy form. It was Genesis chapter 16 that opened my eyes to that when I first taught through this book back in the early 90s, when we first started Bible Study Fellowship. I think it was like the second or third year that we went through this book, and when I got to Genesis 16 and the conversation that the Lord has with Hagar in the wilderness, it became clear to me that this book is all about the message of Christ himself. And so that's why I've gone back to this book. I've had the opportunity to preach from this chapter before. On a Sunday morning, I've focused on this chapter a number of times in various events, and I use the example of Hagar frequently because I think it's so very apropos to the presentation of the gospel of Christ. So this morning, I hope to, in a sense, make some sense out of it for you and hopefully give you that same sense of depth about it. We are introduced at the beginning of the chapter to the fact that Abram's wife, Sarai, I guess you would call her at this point, was without children. We already knew that from earlier in the book, so that's not news. She has no children, but she did have a female servant by the name of Hagar. Hagar, being Egyptian, implies that she was brought back from Egypt during the days that they went and sojourned there during the famine back in previous chapters, in chapter 12. So here we have a girl, I guess. We're not given her age or anything about her other than that. So she's simply a part of the household, but we know that she's from Egypt. And that's significant, excuse me, not only because of the fact that she came from the time that they were in Egypt, which, if you think about it, it reflects upon why it was a poor choice for Abram to go there, okay? Because now that poor choice is going to start having its consequences. So here's one of them, okay? Now, we are told, of course, that Sarah doesn't have any children. She cannot have children. And so she thinks up this idea. Here's what we'll do. Because you don't have any heirs, Abram, and because God has said that you will have children, therefore, the logical conclusion would be have a child with this girl. Okay, notice verse 2. Sarah speaking, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." So the way it's written? Mm-hmm. The idea is that Sarah is looking to become the mother of a child through a surrogate in Hagar, and that's not unusual. In fact, at this point, there is a tremendous trade in surrogacy in the West. There's a tremendous number of surrogacies going on. And there's now starting to become some serious legal problems with surrogacy in the United States. The sexual and moral revolution has having its consequences. And so we're having our problems with this. But it will also be the same here. This will produce a difficulty, obviously. So she's concerned that Abram has no heir, but she's looking specifically for an opportunity to become the mother, quote-unquote, of an heir, and have a child. And she doesn't quite think through, I don't think, the details appropriately here. Okay. Now, so Abram takes her up on the offer. Abram listened to the voice of Sarah, it says at the end of verse 2. Now, I don't think that was wise on his part either. Okay. Just because your wife comes to you and suggests that you do something doesn't necessarily make it right. And Abram should have been smart enough to say, probably not a good idea here. But he did not. He went ahead and he did what he did with her, of course, and it produced a child. And they had after they had lived now 10 years in the land of Canaan, Abram's wife took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. So Sarah treats Hagar then as a wife in this matter. Now, whether Sarah actually recognized Hagar as another wife of Abram is open to some debate, because the Hebrew is somewhat nebulous here. It could very well be that Sarah is simply treating her as a concubine, but having a wifely responsibility, because remember, the wifely responsibility would be to bear children. So that phrase doesn't necessarily imply that Hagar is becoming a wife. It simply implies that she's doing a wifely duty. And obviously, it's not going to turn out that way, because Sarah has a change of attitude, doesn't she? It doesn't turn out the way she wants to. Verse 4, and he went into Hagar, she conceived, and when Sarah saw that Hagar had conceived, Sarah looked with contempt on her mistress. Okay. She looked with contempt upon her. Or, in other words, she said, I'm not particularly pleased with this relationship. Now, there's probably a number of reasons why, which we talked about last week. There's an emotional connection here, firmly established between Sarah and Abram, and someone else standing in this very intimate position would obviously have an effect upon Sarah. She would begin to be jealous. It says she looked at her with contempt, which means she looks at her with a sense of, I don't like you. I despise you. You have done something I don't like. The reason for her attitude change is obvious, right? She was jealous for her husband. And as I argued last week, I think that that's physiological. There's a physiological connection between a husband and a wife that is produced by virtue of what God created when he established Eve in the first place. He created, in the one flesh union called marriage, a relationship in which the woman becomes so tightly connected physiologically to her husband that someone else becomes, after about 5 years, becomes a rival. This is why you hear stories all the time of women who will run back to their abusive husbands time after time after time, and you wonder, why do they do this? And the answer is because they're physiologically wired to do so. It's how God has created the one flesh union called marriage. There's something being formed there when a man and a woman make those vows, and then they begin to live with each other for a while, and this relationship grows, and the necessary reality is it produces a connection there. And so this is what's going on. Any other woman who provided something as valuable and as special and as intimate as a child to this man would have been considered now by her to be a rival. So here you have a reality. And one of the things that comes to my attention here is that even though we are very early in biblical history, right, we're 4,000 years prior to this moment, we already see the beginnings of the progressive revelation regarding marriage itself. Yes, you often hear people say, well, the Old Testament doesn't treat marriage in the same way that the New does. There's a sense in which there's a more lackadaisical view of marriage going on. There's polygamy, there's polyamory, there's all kinds of bizarre forms of marriage going on. There's multiple wives and concubines and, you know, all these sorts of things going on. And so you Christians don't have anything to stand on when it comes to this idea of marriage. You've imported into the text something that really isn't the case. And of course, very often that argument is being used to justify forms of marriage which are not consistent with a Christian worldview, obviously, right? But I would point back to passages like this and say, no, you don't realize that when the Bible speaks of marriage, it speaks of it in a positive sense in this way. This is actually a positive reality related to marriage. Her reaction is exactly what God had purposed in marriage itself. All of these other forms are aberrations off of what God had originally intended as a result of the fall. And so you look at passages like this and you say, but you see, here's what happens in these kind of one-offs. These are the consequences of these strange versions of quote-unquote marriage that you want to develop. God had an idea in mind, and here's an example of it. True, we don't see the full fleshing out of the revelation related to marriage until you get to the New Testament and you get commentators like Paul in Ephesians 5 and 6 speaking about marriage and what it's all about. I understand that. But that doesn't imply or should not be led to imply that marriage is somehow been constricted by the believers in the New Testament. Rather, it's simply been revealed as to what it really is. And here's a perfect example. A woman who decides it would be expedient, logically, for me to let my husband have a child with this woman, but the consequences of that emotionally are more than she can handle. It's more than she can really deal with. And so she comes to Abram, verse 5, and she blames it on him. And rightly so. I don't disagree with her one bit. He should have, as I said earlier, he should have made a better choice. May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked upon me with contempt. Now, what she's saying, of course, is that Hagar would now perceive herself, having now been the bearer of the child with Abram, in a much higher position than Sarah. She's probably strutting around the tent, saying, I'm the one now that Abram looks to as the real wife, that old woman that can't have children. She's out of the way, and I'm now who matters in this household. And so the wife, the true wife, comes to the man and says, this is what you've done in doing this. Now, I imagine his response would be something like, well, you said it was a good idea, and so I should do it, and so it's really your fault, and blah, blah, blah. Well, Abram's response is in verse 6, do with her as you will. Do with her as you will. Now, notice what he's saying. Do with her and her child as you please. Okay? Do with her as you will. Now there's no mention here of whether or not Ishmael goes with Hagar, but it would seem reasonable that he did. Culturally speaking, the child is probably at this point quite young and therefore probably not yet weaned from his mother. It's highly likely then that Hagar running off is running off with Ishmael. So Abram is really, in this case then, saying, you know, Sarah, I get it. I understand what you're saying. So if you want this child to go away, we'll let that happen. Even though, from Abram's perspective, this was the prospective heir. Mm-hmm. Okay? So he's willing to capitulate to her will in this matter, even though it puts him right back in the position that he was without an heir. He's willing to give her that. He's willing to love his wife enough to say, you know what, yes, that was a mistake. You know, we're both guilty here, but I'm going to let you decide what to do. If you want to allow the woman to remain with certain restrictions, we can work that out. If not, we'll deal with something else. Either way, you get to make the choice in this matter. So Abram in verse 6, I know it kind of looks like he's being somewhat cold and aloof and just saying, you know, whatever. But he's making a decision about the future of his family here in this choice. And so Sarah deals harshly with her. Now, we don't know what that means. It could very well be that she puts some serious restrictions on this girl in some sense and said, you're not going to act like the queen in this castle anymore. This is what you're going to do. You're going to live over here, and I'm not going to have anything to do with you, and you're not going to see Abram anymore, and, you know, you're just going to be over here. It could very well be that that's the case. It's also possible, of course, that Sarah did treat her actually physically harshly. I don't know. It doesn't really say. What we do know is that in some way it caused this Hagar to flee. The pressure of whatever it was put upon her was such that she decided to run away. She had been humiliated. She had been mistreated. She had now lost the coveted position that she had of being Abram's primary wife, you know, having the position and all that went with it. And now all of a sudden all that's been gone. And so she decides to run away. And so she runs off into the wilderness.
But she has not had the child.
She hasn't had the child yet,
though. Correct. I'm sorry. Correct. She has not had the child. Verse 15. So she's pregnant with the child at this point. Although, the reason I say that is because at one time there was some evidence, and I forget what it was. It was years ago when I looked at this, but some evidence that this is not necessarily a chronological text. That although it says Hagar bore Abram a son, it doesn't necessarily have to mean that it occurred after the wilderness event. It could very well have occurred prior to that. Oh, I know why. Given the language that's used by God about the child, in some ways, some scholars might have suggested that he might have already been born. Doesn't matter. Either way, she runs off with the child. And it's highly likely that she's running back to Egypt. If she's going into the wilderness, she's probably going into the wilderness of Sinai, which means that she's going west from where they're at. She's going south and west, which would take her through the Sinai wilderness. She's going quite literally to the place where she's probably not going to survive. Mm-hmm. The possibility of her alone, pregnant, traveling through the wilderness, is not likely that she'll make it there. So she's going, potentially, and she may know this, that she's going to a place where there's very good reality that she may not survive, or her pregnancy certainly may not survive as well. So it is now a time for the Lord to meet with her. And this is, I think, where the significance of this text comes into play. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, a spring on the way to Shur. So she has found a place of respite there, an oasis somewhere in the wilderness. And the Lord meets her there. The angel of the Lord comes to her. Now, remember, we speculated about what this is. This is a theophany. All right, theophany is an appearance of God in human form, or a visible manifestation of God, an opportunity for God to appear in some way. And we see this phrase, the angel of the Lord, used frequently throughout the Old Testament. It appears a number of times, but here's the strange part about it. It's a reference to an angel, but it's not a reference to an angel in the same sense as angels may be referenced in other places. The use of the definite article, the angel of the Lord, seems to imply that this is more than just an angel, that there's something else going on here. So one of the first things that we see is a theophany of the Lord, an appearance of the Lord in some sort of visible form. And then this angel speaks to Hagar, okay? And there's a number of evidences that suggest that this is God himself showing up. First, the angel uses personal pronouns to speak of what he will do, okay? I realize that in verse 11, he does not. He says, you shall call his name Ishmael because the Lord has listened to your affliction. Okay, so you see it there in a third-person sense. The Lord has heard your cry of affliction. Okay, so in that particular case, immediately he doesn't use words to speak to himself in the first person. But he does as he continues on. Or he does before that. He says in verse 10, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. Now again, notice how he uses personal pronouns in the first person sense. Mm-hmm. So if this is just an angel, say a Gabriel or a Michael or someone else, comes to Hagar, He's making a statement of something that he himself as an angel cannot do. For an angel does not have the power to multiply people over time. Only God can do that. So this angel of the Lord, and again, notice the reference in verse 10, is probably, highly likely, a reference to the Lord himself appearing and speaking. Secondly, Hagar knows herself that she has spoken to God. Verse 13, it says that she says, so she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. You are a God of seeing, or you are a God who sees me. For she said, truly, here I have seen him who looks after me. And the phrase is really translated, have I really seen him here who sees me? Would I have looked here for the one who sees me? Who sees men? God sees men. It is God's whose eyes rove throughout the earth. And so this is not an angel in the direct sense. This is someone who appears to Hagar in the divine person, as a divine person. Now, obviously, if all we had in our Bible was Genesis 16, all we could conclude is that God, quote unquote, in some sense, shows up to speak to Hagar. But because we have an unfolding of revelation in Scripture, particularly as we get into the New Testament, we can turn back our view through the lens of the New Testament, back to Genesis 16, and say, that is probably an appearance of one of the persons of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. Because as Trinitarians, we would understand that God is a personal being, but also a God who exists in three distinct persons. We have the Trinitarian evidence in the New Testament of a Father, a Son, and a Spirit. Three distinct persons who have unique relationship to each other. I mean, you see, for example, in throughout the New Testament, the Gospel accounts, I mean, Jesus speaking to his Father and yet referring to himself using divine language. And also referring to the Spirit, and then using divine relationships, like, I will send the Spirit. Who can do that but God himself? So you have this Trinitarian language. So we can look backwards to Genesis 16, and I would argue all of the other theophanies, and say, aha, this is a person of the Trinity. Now, that leads us then to the logical question, which one? I mean, there are three, right? Now, again, many Christians will just simply look at this and say, well, God showed up. Okay, but that's one of the manifestations of our problem with lack of Trinitarian understanding in our day. Christians are not thinking in Trinitarian terms anymore, unfortunately. They've gone back to being Unitarians in a sense of thinking of God as just one being and one person that just kind of shows up in places. But I would say that we need to, as Trinitarians, look at this and say, wait a minute. The logical person of the Trinity who would come and speak to this Hagar is likely to be the one who consistently and regularly makes human appearance. That one, of course, would be the Son, the second person of the Trinity. And the greatest evidence of that, of course, is the fact that it will be the second person of the Trinity who will, at the right time, actually enter into the human condition by being born of a woman, who will actually enter into human flesh and robe himself in humanity to take on the role of the God-man forever. So he's the one who is most intimately connected with the idea of humanity. He's the one of the three who is going to be human 2,000 years forward from this text, but who, even at this particular point, is probably the one sent by the Godhead to go and manifest himself to this woman, have a conversation with her, and make himself known to her, and make promises to her that he could keep. So, to me, if you rewind Trinitarian logic back through the Old Testament, you say, wait a minute, the person of the Trinity involved in these various theophanies is most likely the one who will become human himself. It makes reasonable sense that would be the case. But there's one more evidence here that strongly suggests that this is the second person of the Trinity. And it has to do with the message. specifically the questions that this angel of the Lord comes and asks. Verse 8, Hagar, servant of Sarah, where have you come from and where are you going? It's not like this angel doesn't already know that. Wouldn't you think? I mean, if he is, in fact, God himself, given the evidence before us, he already knows that. Why is he asking her that question? He's asking the question for her benefit, so that she will stop and think about what's going on. Now, she says, I'm fleeing from my mistress. I'm running away. I've had trouble back where I came from, and so I'm fleeing. But the two questions are relevant. They're relevant in this way. They are, in fact, a poke, if you will, by the divine person into the reality of the human condition. Where have you come from? And where are you going? Now, Sarah could answer that question by saying, well, I came from Egypt via the house of Abraham to Canaan, and now I'm heading back to Egypt where I came from. Now, again, I'm speculating where she's going, but given the fact that there's a wilderness mentioned here, it's highly likely that she's going back west to Egypt. It's not likely that she's crossed the Jordan and going east into that wilderness, because there's no place to go in that direction, at least not for 1,000 miles. So at least if she's going in the other direction, she has the possibility of getting back to Egypt. So it's highly likely that she could say, the answer to her questions would be, I've come from Egypt, I'm going back to Egypt. Now, the Israelites reading this book would recognize the symbolism, theoretically, or at least they should. And the symbolism is that Egypt represents something. What does it represent?
Slavery.
It represents enslavement. It represents death. It represents sin. It represents a place where the angel of death visited. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
It's the place that Hagar herself had come from because of the fact that Abram had failed to trust God, went to Egypt in the midst of a famine, wound up getting himself in trouble with this same wife, and wound up coming back. The people reading this book, having been aware of the previous chapter, should have said, I get the question. What's the question? Where have you come from? I've come from a place of enslavement. I've come from a place of death. They should have been able to say, we've just come from a place of death. We've just come from a place of enslavement. We've just come from a place where the past 400 years we have been under the lash. Okay? So the question has symbolism in itself. It's not just a throwaway question. Where have you come from? Well, it's come from the tents of Abraham. No, you've come from the human condition, which is the place of sin and death. That's where you come from. And that's where all of humanity comes from. And that, by the way, is the first question of the gospel of Jesus Christ. What is the condition of the human race? Where do we all come from? We all come from enslavement to what it is that Adam did. None of us can escape the Egypt of Adam's sin. The world languishes in sin and death because of what he did, and there's nobody that doesn't come from it. That's the first point of the gospel. Now, why is it that the typical American evangelical preacher no longer has the nerve to say that anymore? We don't actually say that in many of our gospel presentations anymore. We don't talk about sin and death and rebellion as the place we've come from. Instead, we talk about the gospel as simply good news. If you just come to Jesus, everything will be fine, everything will be great, you'll be happy, you'll find prosperity, you'll find... But that's not the message of the gospel. The good news of the gospel is only good news because there's bad news that preceded it. The bad news is that you're dying in your enslavement to sin. And eventually you'll stand before your Creator and be judged. Where you come from? Oh, and where are you going? Well, I'm going back to the place of sin and death. Where is the human race going? It's going to judgment. It's going to condemnation. It's going to everlasting enslavement to its own rebellion, because that's what hell is. Best way to describe hell is an eternal enslavement to rebellion, where a people will go and be stripped of the grace of God. They will spend eternity shaking their fist at the heavens and saying, I will not submit to you. I refuse to come under your law. I demand my way, my way, my way forever. Now that's a hell, frankly. God gives you what you want. The worst thing he could do, by the way, is to give you what you want. So he gives you. So that's the question. Where have you come from? I'm come from sin and death. Where are you going? I'm going back to enslavement. I'm going back to death. I'm going back to that place. I had a place what looked like a promise, but it didn't pan out. So I'm going back. So what does he say to her? Verse 9. Return to your mistress and submit to her. You may not be treated well in Abram's tents. Sarah's not going to like you. And I can guarantee you she's not going to welcome you back into the tent with open arms when you do show up. You are going to be a second-class citizen in that house. Yes, you are not going to be treated well. No, Abram's not going to consider you his primary wife. No, you are not going to go to a place of blessing. But here's the thing. If you're willing to submit, if you're willing to go back and do what is right, I will give you a reward. And that, by the way, is the essence of the gospel as well. Because what does the gospel of Jesus Christ demand? More than anything else, it demands submission to him. Now, I realize most of our gospel presentations today that are done by the typical evangelical preacher aren't about submission at all. There's rarely a call for actual radical submission to Christ anymore. It's more like, well, if you just, you know, come down to the front and pray this little prayer, the pastor will, you know, popishly declare that you're now saved and you can go about living your life any way that you want to, you know, believing that you're now going to go to heaven when you die. But that's not the call of the gospel. The call of the gospel is a call to radical submission. The call of the gospel is go, sell everything that you have, give it to the poor, and come follow me. Take up your cross daily. Abandon yourself. Take up your cross and follow me. That's not a matter of strap on a bag full of your problems and go through life with your shoulders hunched down thinking that, you know, God's going to look with kindness upon you because you have problems. That's not what he's talking about. Because to Jesus Christ, the cross was the ultimate act of obedience, submission to his Father's will. And so when he says, take up your cross, he's saying, you submit yourself fully and utterly to me. Your life is now mine to do with what I will. This is Jesus speaking. You give yourself over to me. Your hopes and dreams, gone. Your desires, gone. You come and you do my will. I mean, this is exactly why he says what he says in Matthew 7. Remember? Why did he condemn all those people who called him Lord, Lord? You did not do the will of my Father in heaven. You thought you could still do what you thought was good, even though, and religiously speaking, you did. But it wasn't what God wanted. What did God want? Submission. What did God want? Holiness, submission, obedience, a giving of oneself utterly over. Now, Jesus himself says, my yoke is light, you know. I'll take your burden. But what he means by that is, I'm going to remove all of that sense of self-righteousness that you think you need to produce. I'm going to take that off of you. And that's going to lift a huge burden off your back. I no longer have to try to satisfy a holy God. Thank God that he took that off of me. So the submission is a submission to what it is that Christ has done. But it's also a submission in life to go and follow this Christ. You know, why do you call me Lord and not do what I say, sort of thing? So he's saying that to this woman. Go back to this house of Sarah. I know it's not going to be pleasant. I know it's not going to be easy. I know it's going to be difficult. But go back and submit to her. And I will make these promises to you. I will give you these things. You shall bear a son. His name shall be Ishmael. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, and everyone's hand shall be against him. But I'm going to make him, his descendants as numerous as the stars of the sea. In fact, you will notice that this angel makes the exact same promise to her that he made to Abram. Ishmael will have the same promise in that he will be the father of a multitude of nations who will all descend from him, and he will be great. He will have a great name. He will not be the heir of redemption, but he will be an heir of a nation of people. So Hagar is being confronted, I think, with the pre-incarnate Christ who comes to preach the gospel to her. Here's what I want. I want your submission. Let me take care of the end details. For Hagar, there's very little in this, isn't there? There's really nothing for her in these promises, other than the fact that, you know, your son is going to be named Ishmael and he's going to be the father of a great nation. But what's in it for Hagar? What's the promise to Hagar? Go back, submit, and basically disappear for all practical purposes. But that's okay. Sometimes that's what it requires. That's what God demands. So she goes back to do that. She goes back. And when we come down to chapter 17 then, we see how this unfolds. Now I think that 16 moves into 17 in an orderly fashion. When Abram was 99 years old, okay, so you see between 16 and 17, you see a period between 86 years old and 99 years old, right? So you see a period of 13 years go by. So 13 years appears here, all right? And God once again comes back to him and speaks to him again. Now, in verse 5, he says, "No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham." So he changes his name from simply exalted father over to father of a multitude, all right? He says, you're going to be the father of a multitude. It is highly likely that in this 13-year period of time, Abraham has looked upon this Ishmael as the son of the promise, and he's treating him nicely. We don't hear of Hagar anymore, but Ishmael is probably now being treated with this great sense of being at the center of the family. He's the son, right? Now, how much Hagar said to Abram of what God had promised is unknown, but it seems highly likely that somehow Abram would have known this, of what it is that God had said to Hagar. The fact that we have it in our text is a probably good indication that's the case. It's recorded, so it's come down through the oral tradition that's passing down to Moses at this point. So it's highly likely that Abram knows this promise, and he may have interpreted as, this is going to be the great child of multitude, because didn't God say, I'm going to make you the father of a number of nations? And so it's very possible that Abram has misinterpreted this in this way. And so for 13 years, God allows Abram to go along having this child be, in Abram's mind, the heir. But now God breaks into his life and says, wait a second, time out. Okay. He says to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. Okay, Abram falls on his face in worship, and God says to him, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram, your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations, and kings will come to you, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and your offspring after you. And I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. As for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout the generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you, every male. Okay, and then he goes on to explain the rite of circumcision. Now, it's amazing that here you have the first 9 verses of this chapter are all the words of God spoken to Abram. So God comes to him, and basically I think the best way I would describe 17:1-9 is a summary of all that God has said to Abram before, with a little punctuation, if you will, giving it some punch. Okay, I'm still your God, and we're still going to have a covenant relationship. We're, you know, remember, I walked through the split animals, right? I showed you the vision. I gave you the promise. I'm coming back, and I'm reiterating it to you. Okay. But now I want to go one step further with it. And that one step further is, I want to initiate a rite into your situation that will show this covenant. Okay, I want to put a sign to it. Because covenants had a sign. They usually had a sign of some sort of something. In suzerain covenants in the second millennium BC, typically when two kings would establish a covenant between them, they would pass some sort of bounty between them. They would give each other some sort of gift of some sort, or they would establish some sort of thing, a marker of some sort, or something that would show as a visible sign of this covenant. So God comes along and says, here's what we're going to do. Here's going to be the covenant. You're going to circumcise yourself and your male heirs and all of the males in your household, right? And that's what he describes then for the next few verses. Everybody who's 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male throughout your generations. Now, obviously from Abram's perspective, he's looking at this as this is going to be the sign then. Okay, I'm going to have this sign. But remember, it's Israelites reading this book. So it's Israelites who are being told here, this is why you do this. Mm-hmm. It relates to all of these words here at the beginning of a covenant that God made with Abraham, a covenant to establish a nation, a people that would come directly from him. And they know what their lineage is, from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to Jacob's sons. They know what their lineage is. So they know where it's coming from. So they know, okay, all right, this explains why we do this circumcision thing. This explains why we do this. This explains how this is supposed to be. It's all part of the covenant. God himself established it. And it's important. Okay? So now you'll notice that chapter 17 starts off with God speaking all the way down to verse 14, actually. The entirety of the first 14 verses is God speaking to Abram. This is the covenant I'm making with you, which is a reiteration of everything I've said to you. There's really nothing new there, except I'm adding now an additional reality, which is the ritual related to circumcision. Now, have you noticed how this has been working through this book? God comes to Abram and he gives him part of the story. And then he comes again and he gives him more of it. And then he comes again and he gives more of it and more of it and more of it. So it seems to be growing. It also seems to be growing in intensity. Because, I don't know how you cut the pie here, but I'm sorry I said it that way. Circumcision is really ratcheting it up, isn't
it? Name change.
Name change and...
Yeah,
circumcision. A circumcision which wasn't being done as we do in hospitals with anesthesia. There's a whole different reality here, okay? So it's ratcheting this up. So it's when you get to verse 15 then, that you see God now turn his attention to actually pull the trigger on this thing. All right, first he says, as for Sarah, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarah, but Sarah, which means princess, even though it's just a slight variation in Hebrew. I will bless her, and moreover, now here he comes, I will give you a son by her. Mm-hmm. I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings of people shall come from her. Notice how he punches that. Mm-hmm. Okay, up until now, Abram, you have been told you'll be the father of nations. There will be a great number of people to come to you. You've had a son by Hagar. She's been told that the child will be the father of great nations, okay? And so up to this point, probably up to verse 15, Abram is thinking, okay, I'm going to be the father of nations, and it's probably going to come through this Ishmael, and so this is the way it's going to go. When you read verse 16, boom, everything changes. The whole thing changes. I'm not going to bless the child Ishmael. I'm going to bless this woman. And that's why Abram responds as he does in verse 17. You got to remember, the response of verse 17 is following after years of presumption on the part of Abram, right? How old is Ishmael at this point? He's 13. Okay? And there's probably been a few years prior to that. At least I think so, based on the age of Abram earlier, that there's been some time that has elapsed between the time that God first came to Abram and gave him this promise that we have with the cut animals and that sort of thing. So there's been years of presumption on Abram's part. 13 years have gone by, at least 13 years at a minimum, have gone by in which Abram has probably solidified a set of assumptions in his head, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
And so with one statement, God destroys all of those presumptions. I'm going to give her a child. I think this is one of those statements that I really do think proves that God has a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
You've been thinking all along, Abram, that it's this child and this woman and this way, whatever you've got it fixed up in your mind, and I've got a better idea, a different idea. And that's why he laughs. He falls on his face and he laughs. Now, falling on his face seems to be connected to earlier when he fell on his face before the Lord. So it's possible that he's falling down in a sense of humility or reverence. Could also mean, though, that he's simply falling down laughing, saying, "This is preposterous. All right, all right, all right, all right. Well, let me see if I got this straight. You took me out of lower Mesopotamia. You brought me here to this place. I've had a little time in Egypt. I've had a little time rescuing Lot. I've had a number of years. I've had a child by a mistress. I've been doing everything I can to solve the original equation of what you established. And now you're telling me that it's going to come from my wife, who's so far past menopause we can't even see it anymore? Is that what you're suggesting?" The response, ironically, is not that unusual.
Mm.
It's human. It's a human response. This is not a man that just immediately stands up and says, "May it be done to me as thou willest," right? He doesn't do that. He has a response that would be natural and normal for us. "God, you're going to do this?" I mean, he says it. "Shall a child be born to a man who's 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" I mean, even though he lived to 175, he's still, you know, old man. Is this really going to happen? And God says, and then he says, and this is where we get a picture into the mind of Abram, verse 18. "And Abram said to God, 'Oh, that Ishmael might live before you.'" Okay, see what he does there? He's revealing what's going on in his head. "I thought it was this kid, and I've developed a relationship with this boy. This boy is my favorite son, my only son. And so, why can't it be him? Why does it have to be in this way? First of all, I don't know how you're going to do that. And secondly, there's already a kid. Why don't you use this particular kid?" Okay. He questions the reality of God's word regarding the child coming from Sarah, and then he presents Ishmael as a potential heir to God's promise. He doesn't really imagine at first that Sarah could have a child, and because he has a close relationship with Ishmael, he doesn't want to see him overlooked by God, which is a perfectly reasonable response. 13 years had convinced Abram that his child-rearing days were over and that Ishmael had become his son. But here's what God is doing. God comes to Abram and says, "Listen, I want to show you something in this. I want to show you my sovereignty over all things. And you need to understand that my ways are not the ways of man. This is not being done. My plan in all this is not to accomplish this in ordinary means. I want this to be miraculous and supernatural for one very specific reason. You, Abram, will not take credit for it."
Mm-hmm.
Period. You will not stand before men and say, "Look how great I am. Look how special I am." No. You will humbly admit to everybody, "This was a supernatural act of an almighty sovereign creator that did this." Now, who's that message going to? That message is going to a group of Israelites wandering around the wilderness who have struggled with the idea of God being able to do something that they don't think is humanly possible. A message being sent to them. The sovereign God who can open Sarah's womb certainly can give you victory over the various ites living in the land of Canaan, if you are willing to trust him. It's a matter of trust. Do any of us really believe that God, I mean, in our heart of hearts, do we really honestly believe that God can save us from our sin? Do we really believe that? I mean, we think we do, and we want to, but we all know ourselves pretty well, don't we? We all really know who we are, deep down inside. And sometimes we wonder, how could God really save a wretch like me? Especially as I get older and I begin to learn more and more about the depravity of my own heart. The question rises, how could a God really save me? But the point of the story is to say, listen, the sovereign God is capable of saving even a wretch like me. The work of Christ is capable of saving someone like me. It's that tension that exists within us, which is, I don't deserve it, and yet it is possible. That's that tension that we live in. I mean, if you don't believe me, read Romans 7. Read it out loud. Read it as though you were writing it. When Paul says things like, I know in my mind, I know what I want to do is right, but in my flesh, I cannot do it. And what is he saying? There's a tension there. The tension that Abraham felt. The tension of, what? I got a way to do this, but you're going to do this? It's that tension that God uses purposely to drive us to faith. That's exactly what it's designed to do. I've said many times, the law of God is designed specifically to drive men to their knees before a holy God. That's what it's designed to do. The law was never designed to save. The law was designed to drive men to that place of insanity where they had no choice but to literally throw themselves on the mercy of God. I can't do this.
Paul says that in Galatians.
Correct.
If the law would work,
yep,
then Christ was no need.
Right.
Basically.
The law doesn't save. The law is designed for a different purpose. Its purpose is to make you realize the extent of your depravity, the extent of your need, and so you throw yourself upon the mercy of God. That's what God is doing here to Abram. You think you got it figured out? No. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do something miraculous. Or as I wrote it here, God's sovereignty extends to everything, including barren wombs and men that are too old by human standards to bear children. And men who think they have it all figured out. And men who have decided what it's going to look like when it's all said and done. Men who have figured out a way to solve God's problems. And God comes along and says, no, I'm solving my problems the way that I want to. Ishmael will not be the child of the covenant. Isaac will be the child of the covenant. Isaac will be the one. Now, again, you will notice that God adds a few promises in verse 20 to Ishmael. He shall father 12 princes, and he'll be a great nation. But I'm going to establish my covenant with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this time next year. And then the rest of the chapter involves, of course, the reality of circumcision being imposed upon the family. Now, and only after God comes and speaks to Abram about Sarah, does circumcision be put into place. And I think that what's really going on is that now that Abram has recognized where the promise of God is going to come from, he circumcises everyone to say, I believe what God has said. I believe it. And although circumcision and baptism have entirely different intentions, there is one commonality between them, and that's this. They're designed to be a testimony to something that's taken place. Now, we see baptism, of course, differently because we recognize that it's a different connection to a different covenant, thus it uses a different means, and it applies to a different people group. It doesn't apply to everybody in your household. It applies specifically to those who confess faith in Christ. But the commonality that is between them is this. There's an outward sign of an inward change. In the case of the Israelites, it was just being applied willy-nilly. But in our case, we apply baptism as an outward sign. As Paul speaks of it in Romans 6, we go to the water, we're buried to show our connection to the death of Christ, and we come up out of the water to show our connection to his resurrection. And the idea being that we say to the whole world in that ritual, I belong to this Christ. I've died with him. I've been raised with him. Which means I've died to the old life, which used to be mine, and now I'm coming up out of that water to go live a new life, which is his. Again, going back to that submission issue that we talked about earlier. The fact is that we don't circumcise ritually anymore because God has changed, or Christ himself has changed that ritual for a different purpose. But don't forget, the intention is to show something God has promised. So, yes, we can point to our baptism, not as a moment of salvation, but we can point back to it and say, that is the day that I testified to the world of what Christ had done in me. And my trust is not, of course, in the water, but my trust is in what that represents in Christ Jesus. Which is one of the things that we really need to contend with our paedo-baptist friends who fail to see that distinction by making baptism nothing more than the same thing as circumcision in the Old Testament. Because that's really what they're doing. They're aligning the two rituals. There's a necessary attention here. Notice the progression. Abram decides he's going to make things happen, or Sarah and Abram decide they're going to make things happen in a certain way. God intervenes in the situation with Hagar, then he intervenes in the situation with Abraham. He changes the course of the events. So by the time you get to the end of chapter 17, all of what God has promised to do has now been revealed. Okay? Now it's there. There it is. It's all in front of you. You're going to have a child. His name is going to be Isaac. And this is the direction it's going to go. So starting in 18, really, you begin to see the outflowing of the promises themselves in a more specific and dramatic way. So I think, as I said, I think Genesis 16 and 17 going with it are significant chapters in this book. They really are the pivot around in Abraham's life of where we're going to be going in terms of how this is going to flesh itself out. But notice how the gospel is central to it right there at that point, of God intervening to actually accomplish his will in and through people with the message, where have you come from? Where are you going? Go submit. That's the message. It's the same message that Abram was told when he was said, no, Ishmael's not going to be the one. Submit. Here's the submission. Submit to Sarah having this child. So it's the same message delivered twice. So these are exciting chapters, and there's so much more we could talk about. The time went by way too fast, so I apologize that I wasn't able to get in everything I really wanted to get to, but I hope that we hit the high points well enough that you can go away and contemplate these things, and it gives you great comfort across the course of your day.